From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum in our next hour, recent studies show that coral cover along Australia's Great Barrier Reef has shrunk by half since the mid-80s as warmer seas, storms, and starfish colonies kill off organisms. We'll discuss the health and preservation of these fragile ecosystems as we delve into the future of coral reefs, often referred to as the rainforests of the sea. Forum is next. Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of the Forum program. Biodiversity is dependent on coral reefs, but so are a range of economic and environmental realities in that coral reefs globally help support millions of the world's poor by providing food sources, chemicals, and pharmaceuticals, protection of fisheries and nurseries of tropical coastal fish stocks, as well as protection of shorelines. Then, of course, there is the natural beauty of the coral reefs, which evidence suggests have existed for millions of years. Now, with overfishing, pollution, ocean acidification, and climate change, coral reefs appear to be in serious jeopardy. And with climate change added to the mix, they're thought to be, by some, on their way to collapse or even to extinction. How salvageable are coral reefs? That's where we want to put our focus in this Forum Hour. And joining us in studio is Michael Webster, who is Executive Director of the Coral Reef Alliance, a conservation nonprofit. We welcome you to the program. Good morning.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you here. And also Dr. Jen Smith is joining us. She's assistant professor at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography at UC San Diego and joins us from La Jolla. Welcome to the program, Jen Smith.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you. And we also have with us this hour Terrence Gosliner, who is senior curator and dean of science and research collections at the California Academy of Sciences, which has, by the way, its own coral reef. Terrence Gosliner, good to have you aboard.
Thank you.
Thank you all for being here, and I'm going to begin by just giving you what I think are some really alarming statistics to be concerned about. There was a survey of 704 species of coral reefs and an article about this in Scientific American. Nearly a third, according to the article, face extinction. A lot of it has to do with global warming, but over a quarter are badly damaged or destroyed now. And the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration says roughly a half of coral species are declining in the oceans. This all on the Michael Webster sounds pretty grim, and I suspect you probably read Roger Bradbury's piece in the New York Times.
Yes.
I mean, he says, look, it's almost, give it up. It's going to collapse within a within one human generation. Do you see it that way?
No, I don't. I mean, the reality is that there are some really severe problems on coral reefs around the world, and that the statistics you cite are pretty sobering. The flip side of that is that we know that there's a lot that we can do for coral reefs. In fact, there's opportunities all over the world to manage our reefs better, manage our activities better so that reefs do better. We also know that the reefs themselves are resilient ecosystems. We know that they are places that live in lots of different environmental conditions. And so we've got good reason to believe that a lot of the conditions that are changing on reefs, that there are some corals, there are many species that are probably going to be able to cope with some of those changes in those conditions. The key is to figure out, can we lessen this whole suite of different problems that are playing out on many reefs around the world so that the reefs have a fighting chance?
Right at the top would be fossil fuel addiction, I presume, but then you've got all those things that I mentioned, overfishing, pollution, ocean acidification.
So there's two sets of problems that are facing coral reefs around most of the world. One are things that are playing out locally, regionally. They're playing out where people are interacting with the landscape and they're interacting directly with the reef. The other ones are happening at the global scale. The global scale issues are largely related to carbon dioxide, as you've mentioned, and those are going to play out over the decades to come. And if we want coral reefs to continue to be vibrant, thriving ecosystems in the future, eventually we're going to have to solve some of those CO2 problems. But that doesn't diminish the opportunities that we have in many of the places where people are interacting with reefs right now. A lot of the stressors that are facing reefs today are related to overfishing. They're related to coastal development. They're related to poor water quality along the coast. And we know how to solve all of those things. We have the tools to do it. One of the challenges that we face, though, is that there's a lot of places where people are interacting with reefs, and there's a lot of work to be done to try and solve some of those problems.
wonder about the attempt to make coral reefs part of the Endangered Species Act. Back in 2006, this was done to, with respect to two of the threatened coral reef. I mean, there are others who say, look, you've got maybe millions or hundreds of thousands of coral reefs. You only got a few thousand lions and tigers. But what about putting them or getting them on the endangered species list?
So the corals you're speaking of are two species that are in the Caribbean that have declined tremendously. And those efforts to think about the future of these species and whether they should be listed, I think it's worthy of our attention. There are enough problems facing the reefs that we need to be thinking about some pretty significant solutions. So I would say that ESA listing is not inherently a bad idea because a lot of these species are, in fact, at risk of they've certainly shown severe population declines. If that kind of listing can allow us to make maybe some different kinds of decisions that help those corals to thrive in the future, on balance, that's probably worth it.
Well, Jen Smith, let's bring you in here. The reduction of all these adverse impacts really points to almost exclusively human activity, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, I think Michael pretty much nailed it on the head discussing the two different types of, you know, major impacts that reefs face. We've got the global issues that are predominantly driven by CO2, and then we have the local issues, and there's a whole suite of different types of ways that we interact with reefs, that many of which happen to be quite negative on a local scale. But as Michael also said, we do know how to manage these activities locally, and there's plenty of evidence to suggest that by managing locally, we can actually build resistance or resilience into these ecosystems to some of the larger global threats.
You're talking about specific management and conservation plans for healthy reefs, basically.
Yeah, exactly. Like, we basically know what we need to do to keep those systems working at their optimum in order to kind of combat these global stressors, which, you know, at this point are pretty much inevitable. Even if we stopped CO2 emissions today, the cascading, the momentum is there for many decades to come. And so, you know, we would be naive to think that reefs are not going to change due to CO2 emissions even right now. But we still can and we still should really be managing locally to make these systems as strong as they can be when they are being threatened with these other global stressors.
Well, Michael Webster also mentioned the resilience of reefs, but I go back to that article, which had quite an effect on me as somebody who loves coral reefs,
yeah.
By Roger Bradbury. He talked about them as being a zombie ecosystem, and your background is as a coral reef ecologist, and I wonder what you think about that. I mean, what he means by that, just to spell it out to listeners, they're neither dead nor truly alive in any of the functional sense and on a trajectory to, as I said earlier, collapse.
Yeah, I mean, that's...
And the article's on our website, excuse me, I'm sorry.
Yeah. It's definitely one perspective. I mean, I guess it depends on what your experience is with coral reefs. Luckily, I've been fortunate enough to go to some incredibly remote places on this planet and see coral reefs that are absolutely thriving, that are living, you know, as they should be and as they probably have been for hundreds of thousands of years, you know. So I know that there are places on the planet where coral reefs are not zombies, where they're not, you know, on the verge of collapse. Unfortunately, you do have to go really far away from people to find many of these places, but there are plenty of reef ecosystems, even in the presence of local human populations, that are doing well, and that's resulting from proper management and from foresight and from local buy-in from the community that, you know, once you get a community of people that really values their reef ecosystems and the services that those ecosystems provide, then you get, you know, you get buy-in and you get momentum and you get the community working together to protect and preserve those places. Like, you know, many of the reefs around places like Palau are still doing incredibly well. But again, also you could go to the Central Pacific and the absence of people, and you do see these coral reef gems. And so, I guess I'm a believer because I've been able to see some of these places and know that reefs are not zombies all around the planet.
Well, what about reducing adverse impacts? I mean, we've got some new science out of the Scripps Center where you are about bacteria causing a lot of problems and a breakthrough in actually measuring the effects of ocean acidification. We've also got the fact that there's the first full, I believe, coral genome that was announced back in 2011. In other words, how much is science helping us, ameliorate the problems?
Well, there's many different complexities to the problems of coral reef degradation. And as you mentioned, bacteria are, the unseen devils that are out there causing impacts associated with coral diseases. So there's specific types of coral diseases that may be caused by a whole variety of different bacteria. There's just general pathogenic bacteria that are present in polluted waters. You get these cascading impacts when you have other things like overfishing and pollution happening, which cause seaweeds to bloom. You get these weeds growing on reefs, and those weeds end up releasing dissolved organic carbon, which can fuel bacterial populations and also cause coral mortality. So there are many different things that we know of that can cause coral mortality. And certainly the more we find out, the more research we have on coral genomics, there's more we can build into trying to manage specific species of corals that may be more resistant or resilient to these various types of climate or local impacts. But all of the science together, really needs to be used to build kind of a comprehensive plan. And as I mentioned before, I think our biggest hope right now is managing some of the human impacts at a local level to try to build build these systems to make them stronger to better resist these climate impacts.
Again, Dr. Jen Smith is with us from La Jolla. She's assistant professor with the Scripps Institution of Oceanography, UC San Diego. And Terrence Gosliner is senior curator and dean of science and research collections over at the California Academy of Sciences. And one thing, again, that we've learned, I suppose, and maybe you could spell this out for it in terms of importance, Terrence Gosliner, is that strong currents and deep water is more resilient than more shallow areas.
Absolutely. And one of the things that we've seen, particularly in different areas of the Philippines, when coral bleaching events, which are one of the sure signs that a reef is stressed, and basically coral bleaching is when the corals who depend on symbiotic algae that live inside their tissues, when the corals are stressed, usually by elevated seawater temperature, they expel their zooxanthellae and they appear ghostly white in color. They're still alive, generally speaking, but this is a sheer sign of stress. And basically, we found that there are areas that are more resilient, particularly where there's deeper water and stronger currents in the Philippines, where in bleaching events, within a couple of months, the corals are back, have regained their color, indicating that they have new algae that they've brought on board to provide nutrition to the corals. And basically, those corals can recover very quickly, which is a very hopeful sign. And I think one of the things that, following up on what both Michael and Jen have said, is that local communities can do a tremendous amount of work to stabilize the health of the coral systems that are in their own backyards. And in the work that we've done in the Philippines, I've been going there for over 20 years, and many of the reefs that I visited today are in much better shape than when I first went there. And so to what do we attribute that? And basically, it's because communities have become stewards of the reefs that are in their surrounding areas. And I can give you one really good case study that we have, where a local community was really realizing that they were catching very few fish, that they were almost entirely dependent on for the primary food source for the community, was just terribly degraded. And I dove on that reef about 15 years ago, and it was in very tough shape. What happened was a very enlightened and heroic woman community leader said that they needed to do something about their reef, and they basically curtailed any fishing or any scuba diving or any activity on that reef for up to 6 years. So that was the plan. and they would stand guard over that reef. And if intruders came in, here's where technology is tremendously important, is that they would text other members of that community, and within a few minutes, they would surround the intruder and wait until the authorities arrived, and then the intruding vessel was then confiscated often.
Well, that's an inspiring story.
It really is. Yeah. And then, so 6 years elapsed, and our group from the California Academy of Sciences was the first group that was allowed to dive on that reef after that 6 years. And all around us were schools of small fish, new coral heads that had developed, and you can see the resilience and the ability. If you give those systems half a chance, they can rebound tremendously rapidly, and it's that sense of a long-term perspective that those communities embrace that has been really successful in turning the tide of decimation of reefs.
Now, they're embracing something that has to do ultimately with their own survival as well. And I know a lot of your work, Terrence, has been in the Philippines. And in fact, I mentioned earlier, another plug, California Academy of Sciences has this wonderful coral reef from the Philippines, actually, that can be seen by visitors. But you also did some work down under in Australia. And excuse me, as I said earlier, the Great Barrier Reef has shrunk by half since the mid-80s because of warmer seas and storms, but also you got starfish colonies killing off organisms. And the starfish issue is another real threat to coral reefs. The population increases and it eats coral.
Absolutely. That is one of the crown of thorns starfish is one of the most voracious predators on corals that there is. And periodically there are outbreaks of large populations. And generally, it's thought to be a combination of a wide variety of stressors on the environment. And I think here the key is eliminate the stressors in the environment and the resilience increases markedly. But the stressors include things like elimination of the natural predators on the crown of thorns starfish. There's a couple of large snails that are predators on the starfish, and they're often collected for the shell trade. And so when those predators are eliminated, then there's nothing to control the growth of the starfish. But also, what's thought to be, in the case of the Great Barrier Reef, the greatest threat is the influx of nutrients from runoff from fertilizers that are used for agricultural purposes in the terrestrial environment immediately offshore, onshore. So it's, you know, I think one of the things that reinforces to us is that there is a tremendous connectivity between the land and the ocean. And often people think of these as really independent ecosystems, but in fact they're intricately connected. And good stewardship involves all of the elements of a shoreline community, from the watershed all the way out to the deepest drop-offs of the reef.
Well, we're talking about the future of coral reefs, and let me invite those of you listening to join this conversation. We certainly welcome your contributions, and you can join us a number of ways, by phone. In fact, we welcome your phone calls, and our toll-free number is available now. It's 866-733-6786. Feel free to join the conversation. We do welcome your questions or comments. 866-733-6786. Concerned about the future of coral reefs, kind of hanging in the balance here, and you may want to go on record about your own concerns and what you think needs to be done. We're hearing from experts and getting some really expert analysis. You can also email us. Our email address is forum@kqed.org, or you can post any questions or comments you might have on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment. But feel free to join the program. Let me go back, if I may, to you, Michael Webster. And there are some rather imaginative things that I've been reading about, monetizing coral reefs. There's a kid named Tim Richards, a young guy from American University, who is using all this underwater equipment, taking pictures of them and, you know, essentially streaming and allowing people to pay for the survival of coral reefs. We've got Google mapping coral reefs, stunning photos. We've got Google doing, what they're calling the World's Wonder Project. All of this strikes me as being quite positive, but it gets back to the kind of stewardship, individual human stewardship in communities that we heard from Terrence Goslinger, doesn't it?
It does. And, you know, as Terrence was pointing out, there are a lot of opportunities in the places where people live near reefs to change their behavior, to think about different management activities that can help the reefs. You were talking for a moment about the Great Barrier Reef example and the problem with starfish that eat corals. In that case, if you could solve the problem with the starfish, the Great Barrier Reef wouldn't be shrinking. It would actually be maintaining a healthy live coral cover. And that starfish outbreak or those starfish outbreaks are tied to coastal water quality. And what that means is that the things people are doing on land are affecting that reef. And so there's the ability to change what people are doing on land to help out the reef in that case. Those are the kinds of things that people can do when they live near a reef. We also heard the example about people stopping fishing on the reef. Those are things that people have the power to do when they live adjacent to that reef.
Let me talk about another problem, though, and let me go back to you, Jen Smith, if I may, with this, because you're our resident ecologist here. There are lots of jellyfish and microbes. There's an ecosystem that may be kind of Precambrian in the era before fish even evolved. And someone, again, like Roger Bradbury, and again, his New York Times article is on our website, and you can read it for yourself. He talks about the zombie ecosystem, as I said earlier. I'm wondering, at this point, if we shouldn't be looking, like he suggests, at what to do after coral reefs. I mean, maybe the emphasis ought to be, as all of you are saying, on conservation and on stewardship, and that is obviously being highlighted here. But what about the event of, say, a world without coral reefs or a world with very few?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that still comes back to whether or not you're a believer that we're not going to have coral reefs by the end of our lifetime. And I would personally argue that coral reefs are not going to be the same as they are today in 10, 20, 50 years from now. But I believe that they will still exist. They will exist in a different state. And, you know, that state, who knows, maybe the corals will be able to acclimate to some of these different changes that we're throwing at them. We know that some places, you know, we have examples of places near power plants where water is extremely hot coming out of these cooling tanks for power plants, and there's thriving coral communities in front of them. So we know that there are certain cases where corals can acclimate, they can adapt over generations to some of these impacts. And so there's no reason to be expecting that there's not going to be any coral reefs.
Well, you've helped elevate my hope. I tell you, after reading Bradbury's column, I was down in the dumps, but I'm hearing all of you talk about hope here and salvageable. It's often compared to the rainforests, and we should mention Terrence Goslinger as we come up on the break here. There's an International Coral Reef Symposium. We've got 2,000 signatures calling for governments to ensure the future of coral reefs. That's, I guess, hopeful too, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I think there are lots of hopeful signs, and we just all need to be as creative as possible to really focus on the things that we can do.
All right, and we'll find out what our listeners think and take your questions and comments when we return. You can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is at KQED Forum, but feel free to email KQED, forum at kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment. We continue with Michael Webster, Dr. Jen Smith, and Terrence Goslinger. This is Forum. I'm Michael Kresge. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our focus this hour of Forum is on coral reefs, health and preservation and conservation of these fragile ecosystems, which are so singularly important to biodiversity. Terrence Goslinger is with us, Senior Curator and Dean of Science and Research Collections with the California Academy of Sciences, and Dr. Jen Smith, Assistant Professor with the Scripps Institution of Oceanography at UC San Diego, and Michael Webster here in studio, Executive Director of Coral Reef Alliance, a conservation and nonprofit organization. And let's go to your calls, and we begin with you, Joy. Hi. Joy, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Yeah, hi.
Hi. I recently was in Tikal Island in the Philippines. As your guest had said, he did a lot of his study in the Philippines. And being an avid diver since I've been 18 years old from Florida, the dive instructor, who was a local from the island, continually hit the reefs with his fins and grabbing onto the reefs with his hands, being uneducated that by touching the reefs, it can really damage them. So conserving reefs really comes down to also educating the locals into understanding how to handle the reefs. Are we doing something about that within, like, the Asian community or even in Australia, people diving there?
Terrence Goslinger?
Yeah, this is always a perennial problem, but I would say what you witnessed in the Philippines is probably the exception rather than the rule. Most of the dive guides that I have worked with in the Philippines are extremely careful about how they move along the reef, that they're careful with their flippers. They regulate their buoyancy accordingly. They don't touch the reef unnecessarily. And, you know, so all of this goes to education. And one of the things that we try and do in our work when we go to the Philippines is education is paramount. So we try to train the trainers. We have educational outreach in all of the communities where we're working. We work very closely with the dive community and particularly in ecotourism locations. But it all goes down to education and trying to make sure that you have dive operators who are aware and conscientious and hire people and train them appropriately.
Right. Well, Joy mentioned diving in the Philippines. I've got a caller here who brings up the Barrier Reef. Maria, go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you. Yes, when I was at the Barrier Reef, we had guides. I went there several times down there, and it was so beautiful. But the guides kept touching. What kind of a teaching is that? And the other thing I want to mention real fast is that when I was working at the Academy of Sciences in San Francisco, we were told that there are no starfish. There are sea stars.
I'd be happy to respond to that.
Yeah, well, and Australia is kind of in your territory too, Terrence, so go ahead.
Yeah, so again, you know, that people should not be generally touching the reef unless there's an important scientific reason to do so, but as a casual observer, you should be swimming above the reef because you get a much better perspective.
Exactly.
And as a whether they're starfish or sea stars, common names are things that we apply to different things. And the reason that people sort of migrated to calling them sea stars is because there was a concern that people thought they were fish. Well, they're not stars either. So,
no, they're. In fact, I was. I had a great science teacher back in the eighth grade. I remember they're Echinodermata.
Exactly, and they're asteroids of the Echinodermata. But and that's why scientific names are far more precise because there's general agreement to that. But you can call them sea stars. You can call them starfish. Equally acceptable in terms of referring to these wonderful creatures. And most of them are wonderful, and we tend to think of things like the crown of thorns as a demon species that decimates coral reefs. But, you know, they're just making a living too. And generally speaking, when environmental conditions are in balance, the crown of thorns starfish is an important way of regulating the growth of coral and how coral communities function. So it has an important positive role in an environment, except when things get out of balance like they currently are.
Well, let me thank Maria for the call. Michael Webster, you wanted in here.
I did. I just wanted to mention, you know, one of the things that we've been working on for years at the Coral Reef Alliance is exactly this issue people are talking about. How do people interact with the reef when they're out in the water? Obviously, there can be a lot of damage done by divers running into the reef, and it's one of the ways that you can, you know, individually think about how you interact in this system. What we've done is we've developed a series of trainings for marine recreation providers, for hotels, and usually they're very eager to learn about this. They're very eager to improve their practices. And so there's a lot of interest within the tourism recreation community to think through how they can have less of an impact on the reef and really leave just bubbles. If you'd like to learn more about that, we do have some resources on our website, coral.org, that'll tell you a bit about some of the work with those marine recreation providers.
Well, here's a question from a listener named Keith, and let me go to you on this, Michael Webster, and then I want to go to Jen Smith with a couple of other more in her territory type questions. This is Keith, who says, won't some of the reefs regrow in time? I had the good fortune to live and scuba dive on the Red Sea for several years, and a scientist showed us how the reef died out but managed to reform as the level of the sea changed due to glaciers. There are distinct reef edges and remains every 20 to 20 feet or so deep, and at 5 and 10 feet inland and on the shore when the sea was higher.
That's a great question. You know, we talked a little bit earlier about resilience, and it turns out that, you know, corals can grow while they're not incredibly fast growers. They can cover the surface area really pretty quickly. And when the conditions are right, when you have a more or less healthy ecosystem, if you have some kind of big disturbance, whether it's a hurricane, whether it's a bleaching event, whether it's a crown of thorns, starfish outbreak, those reefs can recover. And they can oftentimes recover fairly quickly, you know, within a year or so, even bringing coral cover back. But that depends on the overall conditions on that reef. If those conditions are good, yeah, we should expect the corals to come back. The problem happens when there's so many different disturbances hitting the reef at the same time. So it's incumbent upon us to try and figure out how do we resolve as many of those as possible so that, you know, natural disturbances don't move those ecosystems to something that doesn't support coral in the same way anymore.
And again, if you have questions or comments, we welcome your calls. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Our email address, forum@kqed.org, or you can simply post them on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on the segment. And for you, Jen Smith, a question from Ron in Mountain View says, as some coral species die off due to warming waters, are there other species that would move in and thrive in that warmer water?
Well, that's certainly what we think. I mean, we know that there are some species that are more tolerant to things like temperature variability. There are other species that may be more tolerant to changes in pH. There are other species that are more weedy, that grow really quickly, that can recover from a storm disturbance really rapidly. And then there are other species that are just slow-growing, really robust, and are kind of more resilient to...
Tougher.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Tougher, more robust, basically. So each species of coral has completely different physiological capacities and different abilities to resist these different stressors. So it's not to say that when you have a bleaching event, you know, every species necessarily dies off. You may see some hanging on just a slight bit, but then they'll be able to recover more quickly. So there definitely is variability within the coral group. You know, there are hundreds of species of corals, so there's no reason to think that they would all respond exactly the same.
Well, here's another email, and I'll go to you on this, if I may, also, Jen Smith. This is from John, who writes from Arkansas that he's a coral reef ecologist in training, and one recent paper that addresses the issues you're discussing is by Richard Palnock and talks about the importance of local social acceptance and self-interest as a factor in the success of marine protected areas. The best preserved reef system in the Caribbean, Bonaire, also has an effective marine protected area. I'm curious if you have any further thoughts about this.
I think he's exactly right on the money. I mean, as we've seen from around the world, any place where you have humans interacting with coral reefs, we have the potential for there to be damage and destruction due to fishing, due to pollution, due to coastal development. But when you have the local community buy into understanding that that reef is important for their local economy, for their local sustainability, for feeding people, for generating, you know, revenue from a whole variety of things, just tourism, then people actually start defending the reef and protecting the reef. And it doesn't mean that it's really not practical to think that everywhere around the planet we're going to ban fishing on coral reefs. We know that many people, many places in the world are dependent on fish and food from coral reefs. But we can still manage them effectively. We can manage them intelligently. We can protect certain species of fish that we know are incredibly important for maintaining the balance between corals and seaweeds, for example.
Jen Smith is assistant professor of the Scripps Institution of Oceanography at UC San Diego and is with us this morning from La Jolla. And Nimad is with us from Piedmont. Nimad, you're on the air.
Hi. My question is whether there are any efforts being done to genetically modify some of the species of coral so that they become more resilient to the climate change, warmer waters, change in pH or whatever. I just want to know if there are any efforts to change genetically the corals.
Jen?
I'm not too sure if there has been any successful genetic modification of corals. I know that corals have symbiotic algae that live in their tissues, and those algae photosynthesize and provide food for the corals, where the corals provide nutrients for the algae, and this symbiosis is what's made coral reefs so successful in the tropics, where there's very low nutrients in the water column. Those different types of algae that live in the coral tissues have different tolerance levels to temperature, and so there has been ideas in the scientific literature that you could perhaps make, you could maybe even infect corals with these algae that are the most temperature resistant to make them more tolerant to rising seawater temperatures. But it's a little bit controversial, and I'm not totally sure where that research is right now.
It's also pretty new territory. As I said, the first full coral genome wasn't discovered or wasn't really announced until 2011, just a year ago.
Yep.
Let me go to a caller who's joining us from the Big Island in Hawaii. Philip, you're on.
Yes, hello, and I appreciate hearing this discussion on coral reefs. My name's Phil Hayward, and I live in Puako in South Kahala on the Big Island, and we're fronted by an amazing...
I don't know what happened there. I think we lost him, but he wanted to know. He wanted to say that this is not just a worldwide or global issue. It's an issue that does affect parts of the United States, and Hawaii would be a good example of that. Let me go to some more emails here. This is Susan who writes, how can we ensure that the products we buy do not endanger coral reefs? I was recently shopping for ceramic tile and noticed that Ansax Tile Company is selling tile made of stingray skin. I called the company to inquire, and they told me that it is a byproduct of the food market. They were not able to tell me whether these skins were from any of the endangered stingray species. When I see decorator items like stingray tiles, coral, and other things taken from the marine environment, I can only assume that we are damaging coral reefs. How can consumers tell? Michael Webster.
I think most of the products, especially in this country, that you're likely to see from a coral reef are going to be pretty obviously from a coral reef. They're going to be things like dead dried corals or shells, which involves taking an animal out of the ocean and killing it for its shell or for its skeleton. That's pretty directly damaging a reef to do something like that. One of the areas that also comes up frequently in this country is the hobby trade and people who like to keep coral reef aquariums. The good news on coral reef aquariums is that there's a lot of new efforts to raise those animals in tanks. And so as that hobby moves more and more toward live-raised or tank-raised organisms, then the effects can be minimized. I think right now there are still some pretty significant problems with live collection for the pet trade as well.
This might be also a question for you, Michael Webster. A listener named Shimi writes, I've traveled extensively in Brazil along the northeastern coast between the cities of Pernambuco and Marcio, and I've seen firsthand the total mismanagement of once splendid coral reefs there, such as tourist boats unloading hordes of tourists that stand on the coral, feed the rapidly declining fish populations bread, and leave behind trails of litter in their wake. Yet I have not heard anything about the coral reefs of northeastern Brazil or any attempts to get the Brazilian government to protect these reefs. Does anybody know about the efforts there? Is the international reef protection community looking at Brazilian reefs?
I can chime in on that.
It's Terrence
Gossman. I know that Conservation International has got a Brazilian reef project in their portfolio of projects around the world, and one of our scientists who's a fish biologist here at the California Academy of Sciences is a Brazilian and has been studying offshore reefs off of the central Brazilian coast. And there's been tremendous decimation of the reefs there, but their regulation has increased markedly, and the reefs are starting to come back as of about a year ago was the last time he was there.
So this government signatory of so many governments designed to protect coral reefs is having impact.
Absolutely. And I think that, a lot of ecotourists and ecotourism facilities now have a completely different view of how reefs can be utilized. And this gets back to it is in the ecotourism industry's best interest to make sure that the visitation to those reefs is done so in a very sustainable fashion. And I just wanted to add one other thing about going back to a couple of questions about successfully rearing corals for the aquarium trade. And one of the things you mentioned, Michael, that we have a living Philippine coral reef here at the Academy. When we did that and created that exhibit, we didn't want to extract corals from a natural environment in the Philippines. And we were able to collaborate very closely with other aquaria around the world who provided fragments of species that are found in the Philippines. And we spent about 6 years rearing those things in captivity so we didn't decimate reefs in the Philippines. One of the other things that is going on in that regard is that we are working very closely with the Philippine government and the Bureau of Fisheries there to try growing corals here at the Steinhardt Aquarium of the Academy and to export that expertise back to the Philippines so that the aquarium trade can engage in that kind of activity in a much more sustainable manner. So again, it's education and developing best practices for how one explores coral reefs and how one can sustainably use coral reefs.
Well, here's Lee, who puts the following comment on our website. He says, I've dived off Australia, Indonesia, New Guinea, and the Philippines and seen everything good and bad your guests are discussing. The locals will defend and protect coral reefs if it pays for them, so we can help by going on vacations in these areas, both diving and snorkeling. We can also help by not buying marine tropical fish for our aquariums that aren't tank bred. Wild marine tropicals are caught by cyanide fishing, which kills portions of coral reefs and 90% of the fish nearby. And we can help by pressuring our legislatures to ban importation of dried seahorses, which ethnic Chinese use as traditional medicine, and shark fins, which ethnic Chinese use in soups to show how wealthy they are. Sharks eat parrotfish, which can consume up to a ton of coral reef per year. No sharks, no reefs. Let's go to our caller, Philip, from the Big Island, who we lost a few moments ago somehow. But we found you back again.
Yes, yes. Sorry about that. The connections sometimes are a little bit faulty here.
And I hear a minor bird in the background, I believe.
There are minor birds in the background, lots of bird life here, but most of them are not native species, and that's part of the problem Hawaii has. And my comment is mostly I'm part of a community that's really trying to do actions to protect the reef. We have invasive species like a grouper called the peacock grouper, the roy, which shouldn't be here. There's the community I live in and is mostly cesspools still, and there's no sewer and there's no money. The big thing is funding. How do we fund things like putting in a sewer system so we aren't adding to eutrophication problems on the reef and getting rid of the invasive species? We need a sedimentation study here. We get big rains uphill and big sedimentation problems, which can affect the reef. And it's just difficult for a community like this to find where the funding sources are because the government isn't really capable of providing the funds for sewers and sedimentation studies and such.
Yeah, I think you bring up an important point. I mean, it's not only funding, but it's the geology. Professor Jen Smith?
Yeah, all really good questions. And you mentioned you live at Pu'uko on the Big Island. I'm quite familiar with that reef. I spent a lot of time doing research there, so it has a special place in my heart as well. And it is a really amazing reef for the state of Hawaii. And just having the local community there really value the reef and at Pu'uko is incredibly important. And, you know, hopefully you guys may be able to pressure the local management agency to build a better protected area. I know that Pu'uko is protected at some level from aquarium fish collection, but perhaps it could become a full-blown marine protected area where no fish are collected. And that way, you know, you may be able to increase the number of herbivores, things like parrotfish and surgeonfish, which are really important for grazing seaweeds, which may bloom under conditions when you have more nutrients associated with the cesspools and the runoff. So you can even try to build in resilience within the system to some of these local stressors by having really healthy fish populations there. You mentioned there's Roy, the invasive grouper. That can also be problematic. Hawaii has a number of different invasive species in the marine environment, not just fish, but a lot of different seaweeds, which are problematic. So in terms of funding, though, you know, there's always the state government, which we know is not got a lot of excess funds for doing things like building better infrastructure for sewage, working on similar cases on Maui right now where the sewage problems are larger, more at the county level, where they treat their sewage in large injection wells for the entire island. But, you know, maybe other organizations like nonprofits have small pots of funding that could help fund studies, like you mentioned, on sedimentation.
Well, what about the federal government? I mean, President Clinton actually, it's my understanding, gave out an executive order to protect coral reefs, did he not?
Yep, that's true. And the federal government, I mean, there are always grants through the National Science Foundation and things like that, but those are more, you know, science-specific rather than community-based types of projects. I'm not sure. Maybe one of the other guests has suggestions of where other funding sources might be available.
Michael Webster, you have to find funds, don't you?
Yeah, and, you know, if you're talking about things like water quality issues in the Hawaiian Islands, you know, those the funds to solve that are going to have to come from probably a combination of public sources as well as private sources. There are a lot of people who have a lot of investment in the image of Hawaii as having clean water, clean beaches, beautiful coral reefs, and there's a lot of people who do have this self-interest we've been hearing about elsewhere in maintaining that water quality and maintaining that reef. They go hand in hand in a lot of these places.
Well, certainly vital for tourism. And Jen Smith, Richard from San Francisco says, does coral migrate over time? Can scientists move coral to cool waters? Was there not worldwide glaciation as recently as 10,000 years ago? And where did coral live during the last ice age? How did it survive?
So corals come and go with sea level rise, with changing sea levels and with changing temperatures. So you see coral populations build up and then die back and then recover. So over the millennia, over, you know, hundreds of thousands of years, you definitely see corals moving around. They don't necessarily migrate, but their juvenile stages, they release eggs and sperm into the water, which create little larvae that drift with ocean currents. And so they will establish and settle and grow in places wherever conditions are favorable. So, yes, we definitely see corals coming and going around the world as temperatures and as sea level has changed.
And we'll bring in another caller. Mari, that's you. Good morning. You're on Forum.
Yeah, thanks. My comment dovetails with the ecotourism discussion. I recently saw this nature documentary on PBS on Cuba. It's called The Accidental Eden. Incredible documentary. It focuses on the way that the embargo in Cuba has actually resulted in a really unique preservation of Cuba's ecosystems. And
not to mention cars from the 50s.
You know. Yeah, exactly. And so there's this incredible part where there's this marine biologist who talks about the fact that he really he waited a long time to be able to dive down to look at particular coral reefs. And when he finally did, he said it was like time travel for him, that he saw species that he hadn't seen in the rest of the world in the past 25 years. So it was really impactful. And so I'm wondering if the guests are aware of any concerted, organized effort to make sure that Cuba doesn't turn into Costa Rica Redux when the embargo is lifted.
Yeah, Michael, or turn into Disneyland. I was in Cuba last year, and that's a great concern, too. Michael Webster?
Yeah, I don't work in, our organization doesn't work in Cuba, but you hit on a point that when reefs are really left to themselves, they thrive. And they look quite different from a lot of the reefs that you might see that have been more impacted. That's great because we can use that to understand, well, what is it that makes them thrive? And then we can also use that as a baseline, as a target for reefs in other places.
Well, we've got to do something to reduce these stressors. I'm going to get on my podium here. And Michael, let's begin with you. What can people do? What can individuals do?
So I would point to three things. There's more. There's plenty more you can do. And again, we have a lot of these on our website. You can check that out at coral.org. But the thing that I would begin by saying is there's a lot of work to be done. There are a lot of places. You know, there's scores of countries that need work from a conservation perspective. So you can donate to organizations that are doing that work. That's the biggest one. The second is you can think about carbon dioxide and your own carbon footprint, as well as how you interact with your government and what rules your government sets up for solving some of our CO2 emissions. That is one of the more important things you can do in the long term. And the third one that I'll just point out now has come up a little bit already, and that's go and visit these places. Take a look at the reefs for yourself and support the local industries that rely on healthy coral reefs to survive. If they rely on them, if their self-interest is tied to that coral reef doing well, they're more likely to make the decisions that will keep that coral reef healthy over time.
Anything to add, Terrence Gosliner or Dr. Jen
Smith? Well, I just want to reinforce what Michael said. I think those are the key points. But I would underscore that communities can effectively regulate what goes on, but they're powerless to deal with the whole issue of climate change. And here's where the developed world has a particular responsibility of developing new strategies to reduce our carbon footprint. And governments, particularly in the developed world, but all of us as individual citizens, can make a huge difference by developing more sustainable, more carbon neutral ways of existing.
With seconds left, anything to add, Dr. Smith?
Would just also like to support everything that those guys said. Reduce our carbon footprint. Make informed decisions. Buy locally. Live as sustainably as we can, and support local organizations that are out there to protect and preserve reefs in the future.
All right, we thank you, Jen Smith and Terrence Gosliner and Michael Webster. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi, Tina Larberg, with production assistance from Suki Lewis. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.